Are you ready to lose weight? With Effecty, getting access to powerful GLP-1 weight loss medications has never been easier or more affordable. Effecty offers compounded semaglutide, the same active ingredients as the popular name brands, but for up to 80% less. These medications work by regulating appetite and blood sugar, helping you lose weight in a sustainable, science-backed way. Getting started is so simple. Just fill out a short medical questionnaire, then connect with a licensed provider through a quick chat-based telehealth consultation. If you're eligible, your prescription gets shipped straight to your door. No hassle, no waiting rooms. With transparent pricing, no hidden fees, and no membership required, Effecty is committed to making proven weight loss treatments accessible to everyone. Effecty gave me the opportunity to try their service out, and I have to say, it is just as easy as they say it is. I filled out the questionnaire, and within days, a package arrived at my door filled with everything I needed and detailed instructions. Their website also tells you everything you need to know, and you can always chat with your healthcare provider. It really is that simple and convenient. So if you're ready to level up your weight loss game, my listeners can now get $50 off of GLP-1 weight loss treatments at Effecty.com with code ATTWG at checkout. That's Effecty.com, EFFECTY.com, and use the code ATTWG to get $50 off your first month of GLP-1 weight loss treatment. No hassles, no memberships, and no hidden fees. So get started today. With Mother's Day around the corner, are you thinking about a truly special gift for your mom? Let me tell you about mylifeinabook.com. It's a unique service that turns your mom's life stories into a beautiful book. Here's how it works. Every week, mylifeinabook.com will send her a question via email. These can be pre-written questions about her life or any custom questions that you wish to ask. And then she can either type a response or use their voice to text feature, and mylifeinabook.com compiles all of her responses into a beautiful keepsake book. And guess what? They can even create an audiobook using her voice recordings. It's like preserving her voice and stories for eternity. Imagine discovering stories about her youth, adventures, and the challenges she overcame. This book becomes a legacy. It's something that you and future generations can treasure forever. Your mom's given you a lifetime of stories. This is your chance to give her a way to share them. And this is something that Ethan and I had been thinking about doing with our parents. We have this podcasting equipment, so we wanted to find a way for them to tell their story. But I love this because it's so regimented. They send them a question every week, and it just makes it really easy and turnkey. And it just seems like a great way for us to get our parents' stories down so that our children and our children's children can have them. So if you're interested, check out mylifeinabook.com and use code ATTWG at checkout for 15% off. Create an unforgettable gift for your mom this Mother's Day. That's mylifeinabook.com and use code ATTWG for 15% off today. Has it ever felt like you're doing everything right? You're eating healthy, you're working out, and yet your energy still crashes, or your mood swings hit out of nowhere, like a twist in a crime story that you didn't see coming. Listen, I've been there too, and what I've discovered is that many of these issues could be tied to hormonal imbalances, like a hidden criminal lurking in the background, throwing everything off track. But here's the good news. This is one mystery that you can solve with Happy Mammoth. There's no need for a long investigation. Just take the free 2-minute quiz from Happy Mammoth. You answer a few questions about what you're experiencing and where you're at in life, and you'll uncover the real culprit behind your hormonal symptoms. And the best part? After taking the quiz, you'll get a personalized recommendation to help you balance your hormones so you can finally feel like yourself again. According to a survey, after taking Hormone Harmony, 86% of women started to lose weight. 77% said that it improved their mood. And the biggest benefit? 100% of women surveyed said they're feeling like themselves again. For a limited time, you can get 15% off your entire first order at happymammoth.com. Just use the code ATTWG at checkout. That's happymammoth.com and use the code ATTWG for 15% off today. Over three seasons of this podcast, we've covered over 80 unsolved missing persons cases. Some have had major breakthroughs, like the case of missing brothers Orne and Orson West, whose adoptive parents have been arrested for their murder, along with that of missing pregnant woman Akia Eggleston, whose boyfriend has been arrested for both her murder and the murder of their unborn child. This week, we're going to check in on those and a few more stories that we've told and let you know what's going on with them today. When a person goes missing, there's a special kind of pain in the not knowing. I want to tell you the stories of those who never came home. Today, I want to give you some special updates. I'm Kona Gallagher, and this is And Then They Were Gone. Welcome back, everyone. Thank you for joining just me, unfortunately, once again. As you can tell, this is not our normal content, not our normal episode. Ethan has once again been kidnapped by his job, so I am on my own right now. But I've been wanting to do an update episode, so it felt like the perfect time to do that. So he's still going to be irritated that I did an episode without him, but let's be clear where my loyalties lie. It's with you guys. It's not with him. And full disclosure, so, you know, I wrote all this and I was going to record because, like, he was literally working a 20-hour day and then working, like, a 16-hour day tomorrow, and we just were not going to have a chance to record. But he randomly came home early tonight, and by early, I mean he worked a 17-hour day instead of a 20-hour day, and I was just, like, tippity-typing away at my laptop because the kids were asleep. And he came in, he put his stuff down, he like put his like travel mug in the sink and he rinsed it out because I always like yell at him for not rinsing out his mugs and his like Tupperware that he takes to work. So he rinsed it out and he came and he looked at me and he just said, "I'm not recording tonight." And I said, "Listen, I didn't expect you to. You're not allowed to like get mad at me because you weren't supposed to be home. And we needed to do something." So anyway, that's where we are. And we're going to do some updates because a lot more has happened than even I realized when I sat down to write this. So let's go ahead and get started. The first story I want to update you on is the one that I mentioned in the intro, Orne and Orson West. Orne and Orson were 4 and 3-year-old brothers who had been adopted by Trizelle and Jacqueline West after their biological parents had their parental rights terminated by the state of California. The Wests already had 4 children, so the brothers brought the total up to 6. In September of 2020, the family moved from Bakersfield, California to California City, California. On December 21st, 2020, Trizelle West called police and reported the boys missing. As the investigation went on, both the police and the public started finding holes in Trizelle and Jacqueline's story, with many wondering if the boys hadn't actually gone missing much earlier than what was reported. And my personal opinion after researching the case, which, you know, I said in our original episode about this, is that they never made it to Cal City. The Wests pleaded not guilty to the charges, and their trial was scheduled to start in May of 2022. However, it got postponed until July. Then, on June 10th, prosecutors slapped the couple with additional charges, involuntary manslaughter and conspiracy. Each of them now faces a total of 7 charges. Their trial is scheduled to begin on July 25th of 2022. Dana Moorer, the boys' maternal grandmother, and Ryan Dean, their biological mother, are suing Kern County for $40 million, alleging that they improperly removed the boys from Dean's care and gave them to the Wests. Moorer tried to take the boys in herself and even got her home approved by the county, but then the county came back and told her that it was in the boys' best interest for them to stay with the Wests. The boy's biological father, Charles Pettis, is also separately suing the county. The boys, who are named Sincere and Classic Pettis at birth, have yet to be found. On May 3, 2017, Akia Eggleston was 8 months pregnant and supposed to be on bed rest. Instead, she went to several banks and ATMs and withdrew large sums of money. Then, all activity on her social media stopped. But it wouldn't be until 4 days later, when she failed to show up to her own baby shower, that her family would realize she was missing. Despite the fact that she was pregnant and disappeared under extremely suspicious circumstances, Baltimore police did basically nothing to find her. It wasn't until 2021 when Akia's story started receiving national press, most notably being featured in People magazine and in the HBO docuseries Black and Missing, that they finally decided to thoroughly investigate the case. In my opinion. I just, you know, wanted to throw that out there. But yeah. It seems as though investigators finally keyed into the fact that, one, this case was eminently solvable, and two, people were starting to pay attention. So, in about 6 months, they were able to make an arrest. So, you know, just to clarify the timeline, 4 years, nothing. 6 months, oh, look, we solved the case. Funny how that works. On February 2nd, 2022, police arrested Michael Robertson, Akia's boyfriend, and the father of her unborn child at his home in Michigan. He was charged with 2 counts of first-degree murder and 2 counts of second-degree murder. He was extradited to Baltimore, Maryland, where he is currently awaiting his trial. In May of 2022, Akia and her unborn baby, whom she was going to name Anubis, were both added to the list of Baltimore's homicide victims. Now, I hadn't heard anything else since then about Robertson's trial or the case, you know, anything, right? And so I was thinking, well, you know, I've been busy. Maybe I just missed it, even though we're in Northern Virginia. Baltimore is like not even an hour and a half from us. So it's basically local news. But, you know, I don't hear everything. I'm not omniscient, whatever. So I went on to Google and did a little search, you know, assuming that I had missed something, but it turns out that I really hadn't. The only news stories that I was able to find since February were from April, which were the stories about Akia and Anubis being added to the list of Baltimore homicides. So I was like, okay, well, that's really not much of an update. I mean, he was arrested in February for murder, so it's not shocking that they were added to the homicide list. So I tried to look up his criminal record, if I could find out just through the court system if he had any hearings coming up or if he has previously had hearings, like what was going on. So when I did, I found that he had several entries in the Maryland court system dating back to 2001, when Robertson would have been just 20 years old. And this is just me being a narcissist, I guess, but I knew his general age. When I looked this up, I found out his actual birthday, and his actual birthday is just literally 1 day before mine. So it has nothing to do with anything. It's, again, just me making it about me, but I didn't like it. So anyway, 2001, you know, is when all of this starts, at least in the records that I was able to find. He was 20 years old at the time. Now, the first charge that I saw was for second-degree assault with a deadly weapon. After that, there were charges for driving without a license, marijuana possession, and trespassing. There's also a domestic violence charge in 2010 that resulted in a temporary protective order being issued against him. He also added a theft charge and some jail time to that in 2012. It's hard because Baltimore is a, we'll use the word interesting, city in that the police enjoy and have a habit of kind of jamming up Black men, especially young Black men, on a lot of charges. However, what's also interesting about them is that despite having some fairly serious charges, Michael Robertson seems to have escaped any serious consequences. And what that just made me think of was Jay Wilds. For any of you true crime people out there who, you know, are familiar with Serial or hopefully Undisclosed, I mean, I sincerely hope that if you listen to the first season of Serial, you also listen to the first season of Undisclosed. But Jay Wilds was kind of like that too. He was the one who gave the testimony that Anand Syed, you know, killed Haman Lee. But if you look at his arrest history too, like he has a lot of like arrests for fairly serious crimes that he, again, evaded serious consequences for. So I just find that very interesting. And I only know, you know, the ins and outs of Baltimore police and their criminal justice system from like living kind of nearby and, you know, being engaged in this space. But it does seem to be at least somewhat of a pattern. So anyway, so Michael Robertson, you know, no stranger to the legal system is my point. So by the time we get to May of 2017, which is when IKEA disappeared, Robertson's potential motive starts to become clear. And again, this is, you know, my personal opinion. It's just what I was able to extrapolate from what I was able to find online about his court cases. But this is what I found in the court records. Starting in 2004, a woman who I won't identify, but also has the last name Robertson. So apparently this guy has been married before. Again, don't know. I'm just going on the fact that her last name is also Robertson. She makes a complaint for unpaid child support. It appears that he basically never showed up for any of the hearings or, you know, answered any of the complaints, the subpoenas, anything. And the case was eventually closed in 2005. But in 2005, she tried again. Now, it seems as though maybe, and again, Baltimore court records online are not like the most straightforward, user-friendly court cases that I've ever seen. So I'm doing the best I can. But, you know, again, this is not, I'm not a police officer, I'm not a realtor, like whatever. So what I can see is that it seems as though he had made some payments, but he maybe still owed some money, right? So like maybe he, you know, owed 2 years of child support, he had made like three or four payments, something along those lines. And so she was still going after him because he still owed money. So another complaint for support was filed on November 23rd, 2005, and Michael Robertson appears to have blown it off again, and a request for a hearing slash trial was made in July. In October of 2006, there was an order establishing support, and the case was closed. So again, I don't have a ton of information about what happened, but it just seems as though whether he showed up or didn't show up or whatever, they're just like, you know what? You're responsible for this. So you owe child support. And if you don't pay, like, then you're going to have the consequences of that. But they were back in circuit court in 2008 instead of family court, where it appears that she was suing him for support because that case was just Robertson versus Robertson. It wasn't like it didn't involve social services or anything like that. So that seems more of just like a straight civil case. Again, though, it's not super clear. But that case was closed, and it appears that, again, some sort of payment was made. But then, a few years later, in 2011, another woman, whom I'll just call Dee, made a complaint for support against Robertson. That case appears to have been dismissed in November of that year. But the next month, the Howard County Department of Social Services made the same complaint for support. Robertson dodged them, though, and the case was closed in May of 2012. And I should note that in the vast majority of the child custody cases that I'm going to talk about, the Howard County Department of Social Services is at least the plaintiff or the co-plaintiff. There are very few that are just the mom, right? So Howard County was involved very heavily in all of this. So it wasn't just like these women making these claims against him. Like, it was the county saying, listen, you got to pay for these kids, man. In February of 2013, Howard County tried again. When Robertson still refused to show up, a warrant was issued for his arrest. So he was actually arrested, but then immediately let go in April of 2013. The petition for support was dismissed in July, but again, it's just not clear why. In 2015, they issued yet another summons, which was reportedly unable to be served because Robertson continued to dodge both his responsibilities and law enforcement. They were finally able to track him down and serve the summons on July 26, 2016. Now, you know, that wasn't the end of it, though. Like, that was just like one summons, and there were hearings and motions and everything that happened after that, that Robertson just did not respond to once again. And so in December of 2016, despite all that, an order establishing support was issued. But right before that, in November of 2016, so we're talking just like a month before, a third woman filed a complaint against Robertson, and a support establishment hearing was scheduled for December 27th, 2016. It kept getting continued, though, I'm guessing because he once again didn't bother to show up or respond in any way, just as in, you know, the previous cases. So several summons were issued and hearings were set. Robertson was supposed to have a support arraignment hearing on May 8th, 2017, just days after Akia's disappearance. The last time Akia was seen, just to refresh your memory, was May 3rd, 2017, where she made all of those like ATM withdrawals. But it wasn't until May 7th that she was supposed to have her baby shower and she didn't show up for it. So that's when she was actually reported missing. So Michael Robertson knew that he had this court date coming up, and the court date was supposed to be on May 8th. So this was something that was in his world, that was on his mind at the time. So, you know, obviously he didn't show to the hearing on May 8th. And on August 4th, 2017, the arraignment was rescheduled, and the subpoena, a writ of summons, and a copy of the complaint to establish child support were ordered to be reissued. And again, this is like more than we had seen in his previous cases. I don't know if that was just because, you know, it's 2017 as opposed to 2005, or if they're like, all right, listen, this is the third time this guy has tried to do this. Whatever it was, the courts were just like kind of done with him. And they're like, listen, we need to reissue all this and we've got to get this guy in. But he kept on evading authorities and the complaint wasn't able to be served. So on November 3rd, 2017, it was dismissed without prejudice, which means that it could be reopened at a later date if, you know, Robertson decided to come back from Michigan, which is where he was by that time. Dismissing it without prejudice basically means, and this happened in the majority, if not all, of Robertson's child custody cases, it's dismissed not because they were without merit, but basically because he never showed up, like he never answered. They could never actually get it to the finish line. And Baltimore is a very statistic-driven area. And they literally say in the court records, like, this is closed for statistical purposes only. So they closed it so that they didn't have all of these open cases on their records. So, you know, take that for what it is, you know, whatever. Not here to talk about all that. But it is interesting because, again, all of these cases he just like evaded, and they were eventually closed so that Baltimore could keep their statistics where they wanted them to be. And from what I can understand and from what I can gather, and again, I don't know if anybody wants to call in. I'm not a radio show. If you want to email me or hit me up on social media, you know, I'd love to know if you have actual inside information on this, right? If you know if any of these poor women got any money. It does seem like he made occasional payments here and there, but there are some women that it seems like maybe he didn't pay at all. I don't know. Again, there's only so much you can find out from public records, so I'm not sure, but I'm not done yet either. What we're looking at is that by the end of 2016, Robertson had three different women and the Howard County Department of Social Services all trying to get him to pay child support for over a decade. In addition to that, he had two children with a fourth woman, and now Akia was pregnant. So Akia's number five in this scenario. And, you know, I was like, when I was writing this, I kind of opened up my notes for the first Akia Eggleston episode. And, you know, I wrote something like, well, he had children with at least one other woman. I don't know if he had children with more. I'm not sure. Anyway, guess what? I know now. Akia was number five. And at this point, this dude was like 36 years old, just by the way. So he was not the type of guy who wanted to take responsibility for his children. And in my opinion, it seems as though the combination of his existing legal troubles and money owed, combined with the prospect of a fifth woman asking him for money. And again, he's still with the mother of his last two children. So I'm sure there was a jealousy issue there, which we did cover in our initial episode. So you put all that together, right? The money owed, the decade-long legal problems, the, you know, jealousy, the potential fifth woman to be suing him for child support. In my opinion, that was the breaking point. Now, his girlfriend at the time is named in the probable cause affidavit, so I did name her in the update. So, you know, again, I'm not going to name the other women who sued him for child support because that was a long time ago. I don't feel like that has anything to do with this case. But Hallie Pomeroy was Michael Robertson's girlfriend. And after Akia's disappearance, shortly after, the two of them packed up their children and moved to Michigan, to a town where her family lived. Now, when this affidavit came out, the probable cause affidavit, and, you know, he was arrested and I was looking into it and we were recording that follow-up episode, it said that Robertson didn't want to obtain an ID or get a job when they got to Michigan. And I just assumed that that was so he could stay under the radar because of Akia's disappearance. And obviously, I'm sure that was part of it, but he also had all of these child support cases that were still out there. And I don't know the amount of money he owed, but I'm 100% positive it's a lot more money than he had. So there's that. So all these child support cases are out there. And one of the other things is that he was driving on a highway without a license and he didn't show up for like any of those hearings or pay any of those fines. And so his license was suspended. Like, I don't know, it was something like 2 weeks before Akia went missing. So like, dude lost his license. He's got all of this custody stuff. So there are a lot of reasons why he wouldn't or couldn't get an ID or a job. Michael Robertson is currently being held in Baltimore without bail, and he's scheduled to stand trial for the murders of Akia and Anubis on October 4th, 2022. 6-year-old Morgan Nick was attending a Little League game with her mother on June 9th, 1995. She was playing with friends and catching fireflies when she seemingly vanished into thin air. Her case was possibly linked to a few nearby attempted abductions, but despite an entire town and several police agencies tirelessly searching for the little girl, no trace of her was found. There were precious few clues in her case as well, just a red pickup truck with a white cap that had been seen nearby. But on November 9th, 2021, the FBI released a statement seeking information about a man named Billy Jack Lynx. Lynx was born and raised in Crawford County, Arkansas. After serving the Army and working for Braniff Airlines in Texas, Lynx returned to Van Buren, Arkansas in the late 70s. Now, Van Buren is only about 8.5 miles from Alma, where Morgan went missing. And about 2 months after Morgan's disappearance, Lynx attempted to abduct a young girl in Van Buren. Lynx was eventually sent to prison for this crime, which I've seen described as either sexual indecency with a child or sexually soliciting a minor. Either one, not great. So he did go to prison for that and died in prison in 2000. At the time of Morgan's disappearance, he was on probation for sexually abusing another young girl. So prior to all of this, while police did focus in on local sex offenders during their initial investigation, Lynx apparently didn't come onto their radar until around 2018. And I just read that because I want to make this like little disclaimer because of what I get into next as I further researched it. That may not be exactly true. So one article that I read said that he had been on their radar for like 3 years. All this came out, by the way, in late 2021. So they're like, oh yeah, we've known about him for 3 years, but Morgan's mom said that this is something that they've known about for quite a while. So however you want to take that. In any case, in addition to being a local pedophile who went after young girls, Lynx also drove a 1986 red Chevy pickup truck at the time of Morgan's disappearance, which is similar to what was seen by witnesses at the baseball field. Lynx was also driving that truck during the attempted abduction 2 months later. Now, at that time, he approached an 11-year-old girl who was eating at a Sonic restaurant with her brothers and a friend. The group, ordered inside, then kind of took their food outside. And then Lynx approached her and started talking to her about, quote, sexual matters. He apparently had a bunch of money, too, that he was like waving out like a fan. And according to court records, he offered her money to get into his truck and go home with him. I assume that he must have gotten her away from her brothers and her friends at this time because, he was saying all this and then she obviously was scared because this is gross and creepy. And so she ran away screaming and then Lynx took off. But luckily, there was an adult witness who saw this and he was able to get a partial plate of the truck. And that led police straight to Lynx's door. Now, he ended up going to prison for this crime, and as I mentioned earlier, he died there in 2000. Now, the good part of this, of course, is that he wasn't able to hurt anyone else, and he wasn't able to abduct this girl, but, of course, the bad part is that means that at this point, he's not around to answer any questions. So right now, in 2022, the FBI is looking for anyone who may have interacted with the Lynx around the time of Morgan's disappearance and, even in the months and years afterward. So did you live near him? Did you work together? Did you belong to the same bowling league? If you did, they want to hear from you, no matter how small or insignificant you think the tip may be. While Lynx is no longer around to answer for his possible involvement in Morgan's disappearance, there is potentially physical evidence. But this isn't a slam dunk, so let's talk about it. Now, the first thing I should bring up is that according to NBC affiliate KARK, police and the FBI have known about Lynx's possible connection for way more than 3 years. Like, basically the entire time. Like, literally the entire time. Retired Van Buren Police Detective Kevin Johnson was in charge of the Lynx case, this attempted abduction. So when he got the call, he immediately thought that the two cases could be linked. In February of 2022, he told reporter Mitch McCoy, quote, "Your senses are more heightened in what's going on right now. Those don't happen. they're very rare, end quote. And again, so at this point, the Morgan Nick investigation is still growing strong and it's entering its third month. And Van Buren is only 8.5 miles away from Alma. So again, like all these people are involved. They all know about Morgan. And so when they hear about the attempted abduction of another little girl, like, of course you're going to think that's related. It's insane. So Johnson's records show that Lynx was released to the Arkansas State Police and the FBI specifically so that they could look into a possible connection to Morgan's case. So about a week later, like after, you know, his initial arrest, state police secured a search warrant for that red Chevy truck. And listen, I knew that they had like found some stuff, but it's way worse than what I thought. They found hair fibers on the seat and floorboard, duct tape, a tarp, a rope, and a machete. There was also what appeared to be blood on one of the seats. This is 1995, and DNA as an investigatory tool had just basically come to Arkansas that same year. But of course, it was in its infancy. So the crime lab was able to confirm that the substance on the seat was in fact blood, but it seems like that's about all. Like, it doesn't seem like they were able to really at that point do any DNA tests on the blood. Now, the state lab has records that show they retained the blood samples for future testing, but after that, we just don't know. Arkansas State Police released a statement saying that the sample was last known to have been used in a different criminal case. And this criminal case was apparently in a different jurisdiction, but we have no idea what that jurisdiction may have been. So right now, the Little Rock FBI office isn't commenting, and Alma police say that they don't have it. Arkansas State Police spokesperson Bill Sadler said, quote, "At this juncture, it would be inappropriate for the Arkansas State Police to offer any further narrative regarding the evidence as it may relate to the case presently under the jurisdiction of another law enforcement agency," end quote. So what does that say to me? To me, that says they don't know where it is. It's just a lot of words to say we gave it to another jurisdiction probably 20 plus years ago. And, you know, we lost track of it and I don't want to look like an idiot. So I'm just going to say like it would be inappropriate for me to comment. I don't think they know where it is. Detective Johnson didn't collect any blood or hair from the truck himself because he was just investigating an attempted kidnapping. Like that girl from the Sonic never made it inside the truck. Nothing physically bad ever happened to her, right? So like at the time, it was not protocol for them to collect that evidence. Thankfully, that has changed as of 2011. So if something like that were to happen, you know, after 2011, they would have collected any evidence that they found in the truck, you know, of course, if they were able to get the search warrant in the first place. And Johnson, of course, wishes that he could go back and change this, you know, just so he could know one way or the other, because obviously, like, he knows that he had this evidence at his fingertips, but it just wasn't what they did at that point, you know? It wasn't protocol. And so he let it go. But he let it go and reported it to the state police and to the FBI, you know, and it seemed as though they were doing something to it. So, like, this guy, it seems like he did what he was supposed to do, you know? But interestingly, he does say that despite Lisa's criminal history, he's not convinced that he was responsible for Morgan's disappearance. So Lynx was drunk the night he attempted to abduct the girl outside of Sonic, and Johnson had dealt with Lynx many times for DWI offenses since 1983. So for like, we're talking a solid 12 years up to this point. And so Johnson said, quote, "I did not think he was the type of guy that would do that, but that was me personally," end quote. He may not have thought that at the time, but as the FBI and ASP investigated, they interviewed Lynx's neighbors, who said that about 2 months prior, aka around the time of Morgan's disappearance, he had a white cap on his truck. While Lynx was cooperative with the Van Buren police, as soon as ASP and FBI got involved, he lawyered up. So that could explain why they weren't able to go any further down this route, because they didn't have any direct physical evidence. Like, they had the truck and they had, you know, the evidence that they gathered, but like, I guess they just didn't have the means to like properly test it and really conclusively tie it to Morgan at the time. Now we can, right? Like, you need so much less volume wise of a sample in order to do testing. Testing itself has grown in leaps and bounds. And so if we can locate the sample in whatever jurisdiction it was in, there's a very good chance that we could rule him in or out based on the blood in the car. Now, the unfortunate part is that, again, the blood is the only thing that potentially exists. It doesn't seem as though the hair was gathered by any law enforcement agency, although I would love to be wrong about that and believe that it just wasn't gathered by the Van Buren police, and maybe it was gathered by ASP and or the FBI. I just don't know. I haven't seen anything specifically about the hair, just the blood. So either way, hopefully something's still out there. Hopefully we can, you know, get it tested and get answers one way or another. Her mother has been desperately searching for these answers for 27 years. The last update I'm going to bring you today is on the Kristen Smart case. Now, this is the one that we covered in a two-part bonus episode in 2021 when two arrests were made in her 1996 disappearance from California Polytechnic State University in San Luis Obispo, California. On April 13th, 2021, longtime suspect Paul Flores was arrested for murder at his San Pedro, California home. In a twist that was shocking to some, but like not really surprising to many who have been following this case, Paul's father, Ruben Flores, was also arrested that day and charged with being an accessory after the fact. The next day, Dan Dow, the San Luis Obispo County District Attorney, gave a press conference. In it, he said, quote, "It is alleged that Mr. Flores caused the death of Kristen Smart while in the commission of or attempted rape," end quote. And that, quote, "The allegation against Ruben is that he helped to conceal Kristen's body after the murder was committed," end quote. On April 25th, 2021, both men pleaded not guilty to the charges against them. During a bail hearing, Ruben was let out on bond and Paul was remanded to jail. Paul attempted to get the charges dismissed during the preliminary hearing, but on September 22nd, 2021, after a hearing that lasted about 6 weeks, the charges were upheld and the trial was set to proceed. The pair had to enter a plea again after this, and in October of 2021, they both pleaded not guilty once again. The trial was scheduled to begin in April of 2022 after both defendants waived their right to a speedy trial, but even that proved to be a bit too speedy and the trial was delayed. In June of 2022, pre-trial motions began. In one of the first ones, Paul Flores once again attempted to get the charges dismissed, this time because of a podcast. We mentioned this in our original Kristen Smart episodes, but if you haven't listened to Your Own Backyard, you need to. Chris Lambert does an amazing job digging into Kristen's case, and many credit him and that podcast with finally leading to arrests. But that's exactly Paul Flores' problem. His lawyers asked for the case to be dismissed based on, quote, "outrageous government conduct," saying that what they call disinformation was purposely disseminated to the podcast. One of the other pretrial motions was for a change of venue, which was unsurprisingly granted considering how notorious the case is in the San Luis Obispo, California area. The trial will officially take place 126 miles away in Monterey, California. It was there that Judge Jennifer O'Keefe denied the defense's motion to dismiss. The judge also ruled that two separate juries will hear the cases of Reuben and Paul in order to ensure that each receives a fair trial. Apparently, during one of his 1996 police interviews, Paul Flores may have made statements that incriminated his father, Reuben. There are a few other interesting items from the preliminary hearing. One helps the prosecution a great deal. A witness named Jennifer Hudson, who I'm assuming is not the former American Idol contestant, though that would be amazing, testified that in 1996, Paul Flores admitted to her that he murdered Kristen, saying, quote, "I'm done playing with her and I put her out underneath my ramp," end quote. Now, just as an aside, many possible areas of the Flores' properties, because they did have several, have been named as possible burial sites, including an avocado tree in the backyard. But a driveway was looked at one point, so that could feasibly be, quote, the ramp to which he's referring. In a blow to the prosecution, the judge also ruled that there would be no testimony regarding other allegations of sexual assault against Paul Flores. The prosecution is also not allowed to add rape charges from 2011 and 2017 in Los Angeles. Paul Flores' decades-long alleged history of sexually assaulting intoxicated women would have served to bolster the prosecution's case. But without it, they're going to have to rely on the largely circumstantial evidence of him being the last person with Kristen, along with the forensic evidence uncovered during recent searches. From what I understand, Flores has various like alcohol and drug charges on his record after Kristen Smart's disappearance, but like he doesn't have any official violent charges on his record. And with the prosecution not being allowed to bring any of these alleged rapes in, he's basically going to look like a guy who has never committed a violent crime. So that's going to heavily play into the court case, I would imagine. And this is going to be a long and drawn out trial. I mean, the preliminary hearings, like I said, were 6 weeks. It was 22 days of testimony. But, you know, actually, it's technically even two trials. Because again, it's two different juries that we're talking about here with Paul and Reuben. Now, jury selection is scheduled to begin on June 20th, 2022, and opening statements are scheduled for July 6th. The trial is expected to last until October. So I know that was a bit of a short update on that case, but like we will be covering this more once the trial begins. So that's it for this update episode. You know, I hope you enjoyed it, and we will, of course, continue to follow these cases and others. If there are any that you would like specific updates about, please let us know. I know this isn't a regular episode and I was all alone, but I hope you enjoyed it either way. I know that I personally feel so much better knowing that some of these cases that we've covered are gaining traction. So if you or someone you know has any information about the cases I've mentioned today, the information on the proper agencies to contact will be in our show notes and on our website. Now, next time, Ethan will be back, I promise, and we're going to be sharing a recent and active case with you. So please stick around for that because we're going to get it out as soon as possible. Even though their cases have been ruled homicides, Akia Eggleston, her unborn child, Kristen Smart, and Orin and Orson West are still missing, and their families are still desperate to bring them home. Morgan Nick has a person of interest named in her case after 27 years. Though a case may be cold, no case is unsolvable. If you have any information, please contact the agencies in our show notes. If you haven't listened to our full episodes on these cases, they are available in our archives on your favorite podcast player. You can see all of those sources for this episode along with photos and videos at our website, andthentheyweregone.com. And don't forget to like us on social media. We are on Facebook at And Then They Were Gone Pod, and on Twitter and Instagram and TikTok at ATTWGPod. And if you like what we're doing, please subscribe and consider leaving a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts, Good Pods, Podchaser, wherever you're listening to us, Spotify, you know, anything you want. And Then They Were Gone is hosted by Conan Gallagher and Ethan Flick. Our research, writing, and editing is done by Conan Gallagher. Theme music is The Stork by Ketza. Additional music is provided by Kai Engel. And Then They Were Gone is a Little Monster production.
Hey, you can do it!
If you work as a manufacturing facilities engineer, installing a new piece of equipment can be as complex as the machinery itself. From prep work to alignment and testing, it's your team's job to put it all together. That's why it's good to have Grainger on your side. With industrial-grade products and next-day delivery, Grainger helps ensure you have everything you need close at hand through every step of the installation. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
6 months from now, you could be running a 5K, booking that dream trip, or seeing thicker, fuller hair every time you look in the mirror. Through Hers, you can get dermatologist-trusted, clinically proven prescriptions with ingredients that go beyond what over-the-counter products offer. Whether you prefer oral or topical treatments, Hers has you covered. Getting started is simple. Just fill out an intake form online, and a licensed provider will recommend a customized plan just for you. The best part? Everything is 100% online. Prescribed, your treatment ships right to your door. No pharmacy trips, no waiting rooms, and no insurance headaches. Plus, treatments start at just $35 a month. Start your initial free online visit today at forhers.com/listen. That's forhers.com/listen. Compounded products are not FDA approved or verified for safety, effectiveness, or quality. Prescription required. Price varies based on product and subscription plan. See website for full details, restrictions, and important safety information.
I'm not exactly a tech genius, but I knew one thing for sure. If I wanted my small business to crush it, I needed a website that worked like a pro, and I needed it yesterday. Lucky for me, Bluehost made it ridiculously easy. With their AI design tools, building my website was a walk in the park. I could customize, optimize, and monetize everything exactly how I wanted. In just a few minutes, I had a secure site up and running. I couldn't believe how straightforward it was. And getting found online? Bluehost helped me with that too. I perfected my keywords and meta descriptions with their search engine tools. The AI even gave me suggestions to improve my pages. Now I can sit back, relax, and focus on my customers, while my website continues to rank higher and higher on Google. With their 30-day money-back guarantee, I wasn't worried about taking the plunge. And now I'm so glad I did. Head over to Bluehost.com and build something special today.
If you're a lineman in charge of keeping the lights on, Grainger understands that you go to great lengths, and sometimes heights, to ensure the power is always flowing. Which is why you can count on Grainger for professional-grade products and next-day delivery, so you have everything you need to get the job done. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.